is Daniel Garber, the movies for CulturalMining.com and CIUT 89.5 FM. Robert Fisk is a foreign correspondent based in Beirut who has covered firsthand the wars of the Middle East for the past 4 decades. He met with Osama bin Laden, faced angry mobs in Afghanistan, and recalcitrant leaders and politicians and warlords from Libya to Pakistan. Award-winning, but highly controversial, Fisk flouts the conventional slant pervasive in Western mainstream reporting by shifting the focus to the individuals he's covering. This Is Not a Movie is a new doc that follows Fisk at work, tells his story and background, and discusses the stories and controversial issues he's dealt with. Film is written and directed by Canadian Yang Cheng, known for films like Up the Yangtze and The Fruit Hunters. And I'm very pleased to have both of them here with me at NFB in Toronto to tell us why this is not a movie. Hi, Robert.
Hi.
Hi, Yang.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And thanks so much for meeting with me. Robert, I first read your articles when I was living in Japan in the 90s because they reprinted them, I believe, in the they had a weekly column from the Independent reprinted in the right-wing Yomiuri Daily, which is quite surprising. And reading them the first time, it was a real awakening and shock because I hadn't ever read anything like that in Canada. Mm-hmm. So it's funny that I saw them in Japan. So that's what first awoken me to Robert's writing. So, Yang Cheng, I wonder if you could tell me how you first heard of him and what led you to make this.
I was a student in university, and there was a website called ZNet Magazine, and in that magazine they printed articles by numerous authors from, I remember, Noam Chomsky and Edward Said, and I think Amy Goodman as well, and then Robert Fisk. And that's where I first started engaging with some of Robert's reporting around September 11th and post 9/11, jump ahead to today. I was contacted by the National Film Board of Canada, Anita Lee, and producer Nellyfer Pazira. To
known Anita very well for many years.
Yeah. Oh, good, yeah, she's excellent, a great producer, and yeah. Asked me if I was interested in making a film about Robert Fisk. I don't know how. I think you had seen some of my work, Robert. Is that right?
I've seen The Yangtze.
And then so that's you know. I knew his work, and was, I think, in the beginning, obviously quite intimidated by the idea of going to see you, and just, you know, built up this idea of who he was, and obviously completely the opposite when I went to meet him in Beirut. Very, Robert's very charming. There's a levity, I think,
He means humorous. He means
the humorous, lightness of character that I think was like, this, you know, we can actually do something here, and he's actually quite good in person. And filming him, he's, you know, it's quite fun, and that's what we, I think that's why we really stepped in and decided to really pursue a movie out of it.
Robert Fisk, in the movie, it shows you started out as a foreign correspondent in Belfast during the Troubles, or that was one of your earliest assignments. What brought you from there to Beirut or to the Middle East in general?
Well, Belfast, as you know, is in fact meant to be part of the United Kingdom, so it wasn't considered a foreign assignment. No, it may not remain very soon. It may no longer be part of the United Kingdom. So I was there for almost 5 years. But I wanted to be a foreign correspondent. Belfast was fine, right. I asked the foreign editor whether there was any chance of a switch out. And in fact, my first assignment as a foreign correspondent was the post-revolutionary Portugal.
Oh, that says 1974?
75.
Oh, okay.
Revolution was 74.
Right.
I arrived in 75. And while I was there, our Middle East correspondent, the war had started in Beirut. I was on the Times then, of course, not the Independent. The correspondent in Beirut had just got married to a German billionaireess who didn't want to start their marriage in a war. And so he was transferred to Paris. I was asked, would I like to go to the Middle East? the letter from my foreign editor, which arrived in the post office in this Portuguese village, said, I want to offer you the Middle East. It will be full of sunshine and lots of adventure. And the sunshine was correct. The adventure rather too much. But I felt a bit like, you know, Winston Churchill being handed, would you like to be king of Iraq, or how would you like to take over the French mandate in Lebanon? And I set off in a plane as quickly as possible. The war was, you know, burning out in Beirut. That's how I became a foreign correspondent. And there's no doubt that Belfast helped, because in Belfast I constantly wrote things the British authorities were enraged by. I wrote things about British troops who were brutalizing Catholics in the streets of Belfast. And also, of course, it was a very tiny war compared to what I regularly see now in the Middle East. But you saw people who were shot dead. I saw British soldiers shot dead off the back of a truck. I remember seeing a tortured and murdered Protestant, tortured and murdered by his own Protestant colleagues, I might add. It was a tiny war, but it set you off on two things. First of all, you knew that war was about death, not about victory and defeat. And secondly, you had to realize that if you fought the authorities, you'd have to fight your colleagues too.
So moving to talking about war and not being about winning and losing, but about the horrible destruction it did. You faced some controversy recently when there was alleged chemical weapons used in Douma. Is that
Douma?
Yes,
Douma, that's correct, yeah.
In
it's
Syria.
It's in the film. Yeah.
Yes. And it led to very widespread speeches and indignation and anger and talks,
abuse,
but also by foreign leaders. But to me, that begs the question. There's 400,000 dead so far, at least, in Syria. And I didn't see any cries of indignation when people were being killed by conventional weapons. What is it about chemical weapons that deserves more foreign reaction?
The outrage about chemical weapons is that they're trying to get rid of the Assad regime. What they plan to put in its place, we don't know. They had a good try with opposition, and then the opposition had to be armed, and then the armed opposition turned into Islamists who turned out to be bombing Paris. You see, it went wrong, as it always does, as it did in Afghanistan with the Americans, as it did in Vietnam, so on. And what they were trying to do is say, we are outraged, a red line has been crossed, he's making gas normal, which is rubbish. We armed Saddam Hussein decades earlier with gas, which he used and killed tens of thousands of Iranians and Kurds.
And Kurds, yes.
So why is it so strange? Well, the answer is that we got rid of Saddam and now we'd like to get rid of Assad. My context of being a reporter is not to I know what they're trying to do, but I think Assad does use gas, and I think ISIS has used gas as
That's
well.
Right.
I don't dispute that, but I was able to get to Douma very fast after the alleged chemical attack. And of course, the Western American and English British allies, I get used to that phrase, don't we, had fired missiles into Syria on the basis that they had used gas. Now, I got into Douma and was quickly able to be on my own and walk around among thousands of people. I went to the hospital, which you see in the video, and so on. The doctors who were present on the night of the alleged attack were already giving their evidence to the Special Commission on Chemical Warfare, International Commission. They said, by the way, that they had no evidence of it. The only doctor I could find was the head of the clinic, who said to me, people were brought in suffering from hypoxia. There was so much bombing by the Russians and the Syrians, so much dust that people thought there was gas and came in and were panicking. So I wrote my story, and basically I said, look, I don't know if gas was used. I'm not sure it was. It might have been. And it was interesting how quickly this sort of match dropped in the petrol. It went up like a fire, a bonfire, as I knew it would, because there's such a accretion, an alliance now between governments and press and media, that you didn't have to be a government leader to condemn Robert. You just had to wait for the Times and the Telegraph and whoever else. And it was the same thing I had. You in Northern Ireland, if you wrote about the British, you were supportive of Crown forces. If you wrote about Catholics brutalized, then you were pro-IRA, therefore you were terrorist. The same thing happened in Bosnia. You know, if you were in Belgrade, it was pro-Serb, and it happened the same thing in, you know, the Israelis would call me pro-Hezbollah, pro-terrorist, if I covered the war and the killings in Gaza. It just goes on. So here was sort of episode 78 of the same serial. Mm. Abuse because governments, and I said you I told you in Belfast, if you attack the authorities, you will be attacked by your own colleagues as well, you see. So this became very much another of the same stories for me. I was kind of used to it. I wasn't surprised. I don't, in fact, in retrospect, believe that gas was used. I think my suspicions were correct. First of all, because the preliminary report by the investigation was very strangely written. The English was very contrived. And I'm not bad at English, it's my language. And secondly, immediately after the actual full report came out, it was revealed, and I revealed it as well as several of my colleagues at the same time, that an inspector's report had been deleted and censored.
Is the UN inspector?
Oh, well, they're not UN. They're the
OPCW.
OPCW. It's the Organization of Protection from Chemical Weapons.
Oh, okay.
Anyway.
It's an autonomous organization, but it's under the umbrella of the United Nations.
No, it's
separate.
Not. It's
separate.
Not.
Okay.
But in any event, this inspector's report, which they had they'd covered it up, they had censored it out, made fairly good sense of information that the potential gas weapons, two canisters which they claimed were dropped by Russian or Syrian helicopters, had been placed by human hand inside this building. So the case was beginning to fall apart. Now, since then, it's been forgotten, of course, you see, until I'm stupid enough to suggest another gas may not have been real. But this was important because the result of this alleged gassing, which might still have been gassing, but I doubt it, was attacks with cruise missiles by major powers. Then I went to one of the buildings that the cruise missiles had attacked in Damascus, and the result was that I went right over that place, and it was, in fact, I went to one of the buildings that was hit by 12 American cruise missiles, and I went through the rubble, and nobody stopped me. I mean, they said, you can go and look, it's up to you. And a lot of the material I found was actually based on Egyptian science investigations and French science investigations into the building of bridges in hot temperatures with a rubber sheet between the tarmacadam. I'm just telling you what I found. I got the documents.
Right.
And oddly enough, when I eventually got to meet the director of the guy, he said, well, we've been investigating the effect of deep heat on modern bridge building. He says, well, this is interesting. He didn't know I got the documents. So I found these documents. He told me about them. And I said, look, was there any nuclear war, gas war application? He said, look, if there was, you'd be dead and so would I. You walked in among the rubble, which is true. I don't think it had anything to do with it. And the same institute, Organization of Prevention of Chemical Weapons, had actually cleared this particular building 6 months before of it being any danger. So it was clear to me, and I did a lot of work and a lot of reading, that this story was basically wrong. So, as has happened so many times before, the media said, I'm pro-Russian, pro-Syrian, pro-Baathist, pro-terrorist, you name it. And as I say in Young's film, oh, what the hell, I don't care. If you want to abuse me, yeah, but I've written my story and there it is. That's bad luck to you. Good luck. You know.
And just to go back to that, it's also, you say at the top of the Duma scene that you know, we have to question the story, and you know, question
the story being gas was used.
Yes, exactly.
And all, you know, I was doing was saying, hang on, I'm not quite satisfied by this, and that was the problem, because Robert Fisk had gone there and was on his own in Duma and couldn't prove the gas attack. Immediately, I was to be abused, called controversial, which you called me. I don't think I'm controversial at all.
Controversial meaning?
Controversial means dodgy.
I didn't mean it as dodgy or sketchy. I meant it as other people criticize you when you, about what you write.
And therefore, it happens. Yes, yeah. Of course it does. Yeah.
Finally, can you tell me why is the movie called This Is Not a Movie? Is that a This Is Not a Pipe reference?
Oh, that's interesting.
French avant-garde art.
Yeah. No, actually, it's a direct line from a quotation from Robert in the film. Oh. And it's referring to the idea that, well, simply put, that, you know, this isn't a Hollywood movie. This is not a movie. I mean, this is real life. And I think that's the context in which we're using the title.
Well, thanks so much for talking with me, both of you.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Robert Fisk and Young Chang about their new documentary called This Is Not a Movie, opening soon in Toronto. This is Daniel Garber, the Movies, each Friday morning on CIUT 89.5 FM and on my website, culturalmining.com. I recorded this interview in 2019 at TIFF. Robert Fisk died earlier this week after a short illness.